This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Stillwater, a Jack McBride mystery, written by Melissa Lenhart, narrated by William Dufresne. Chapter 1. Thursday. 1. A line of flashing blue and red lights led the way to a pale green single-wide trailer. Firemen, sheriff deputies, and EMTs huddled in front of the house, talking, looking around, and laughing. All eyes turned to Jack McBride's car as it pulled into the dirt-packed front yard, which doubled as the driveway. Jack set the alarm on his phone. "Stay in the car," he told his 13-year-old son, Ethan. He opened the door, got out, and leaned back in. "I mean it."
"I know, Dad."
Neighbors grouped behind yellow crime scene tape. Some wore pajamas. Others wore work clothes. Women held babies. Children craned their necks to see better, eager for information to share at school. A young officer guarded them, Officer Nathan Starling. It was his file that had fallen from Jack's lap when he was startled awake by the early morning call. If Jack hadn't read Starling was the youngest and newest member of the force, he would have guessed it from his role as crowd control. Starling shifted on his feet and looked over his shoulder at the crowd, as if debating whether he should leave his post to introduce himself or stay put. Jack waved an acknowledgement to him and moved toward the trailer. Jack nodded at the group of first responders as he walked by and received a couple of muttered hellos in return. Some looked from Jack to Ethan and then back. Jack climbed the uneven concrete steps, stopped at the door, and put on paper booties and gloves. Behind him, he heard a low conversation start back up. The words, "alone," "wife," and "no one knows," carrying across the yard as if announced through a bullhorn. The screen door slapped shut behind him, cutting off the rest of the conversation. The smell of chili, paprika, and cumin hung in the air of the trailer. Flimsy wooden cabinets, topped with a chipped orange Formica counter, were wedged against the back wall of the main room by a strip of ugly, peeling linoleum. Brown shag carpet, flattened by years of traffic, marked off the living area of the room. Left of the door, under a loud window unit dripping condensation, sat a couch of indeterminate color too large for the room. A black-haired man with bloodshot eyes and a green tinge underneath his dark skin sat on the couch, chewing his nails. He looked up at Jack and stopped chewing, a signal for his leg to start bouncing. A bull-necked police officer, his thumbs crooked underneath his gun belt, stood guard over the man. "Officer Freeman," Jack said. If Michael Freeman was surprised Jack knew who he was, he didn't show it. His face remained expressionless.
"Chief McBride?"
A third officer stood at the mouth of the hallway to the right with a portly, elderly man. Relief washed over the officer's face. He moved forward, hand outstretched.
"Chief McBride," he said. "Minor Jessen, this here is Doc Poole."
Jack shook their hands.
"Sorry to meet you under these circumstances, Dr. Poole."
"Hell of a case to get on your first day, eh?"
the doctor said. Jack nodded and gave a brief smile. He pulled the gloves and more paper booties from his coat pocket and handed them to Jessen and the doctor. Jack walked down the hall and entered the room. Jessen stopped at the door.
"Gilberto and Rosa Ramos," Jessen said. "Found dead this morning by Diego Vasquez."
He jerked his thumb in the direction of the man sitting on the couch.
"Says he's Rosa's brother. He don't speak much English, but from what I gathered, he came to pick Gilberto up for work and heard the baby screaming. When no one answered, he let himself in. The door was open. Found them just like that."
They were both nude. The woman lay face down, covering half of the man's body. The right side of the man's head was blown across the pillow. Blood and brain matter were sprayed across the bed, under the woman and onto the floor. A clump of long, dark hair was stuck to the window with blood. Her right arm extended across the man's chest, a gun held lightly in her grip. Jack walked around the bed. Doc Poole stood next to Officer Jessen.
It takes a special kind of anger to kill someone you're in the middle of fucking, don't you think?
Doc Poole said.
Ever see that in the FBI?
Derision dripped from every letter. Jack ignored him. Where's the baby? Jack hoped the revulsion on Jessen's face meant scenes like this were rare in Stillwater. If he had wanted to deal with shit like this on a regular basis, he would have taken a better-paying job in a larger town.
Officer Jessen, Jack said, where's the baby?
It's with a neighbor.
Has anyone called CPS?
Why?
To take care of the baby?
The neighbor offered.
And what do we know about this neighbor?
He shrugged.
Well, she didn't speak much English.
So she could be in the next county by now,
Oh, I doubt that, Jessen said. She seemed like a nice sort, very motherly.
Jack cocked his head and puzzled over whether his most senior officer was ignorant, naive, or an amazing judge of character. He turned his attention to Doc Poole.
What's the time of death?
Well, sometime last night.
Can you be more specific?
Well, didn't see the need. Seems pretty obvious what happened.
Oh, are you a detective?
No, I'm a general practitioner.
You're the JP, aren't you?
No, I used to be.
He chuckled.
Too old for this now.
Yet here you are.
JP is on the way, Chief, Jessen said.
Jack kept his focus on Dr. Poole.
So you heard this over the radio and decided to come, or did someone call you?
Well, do you have the instruments necessary to establish a time of death?
Well, not with me, but then get off my crime scene.
The little man straightened his shoulders and lifted his chin.
I can see why Jane Maxwell liked you.
He started to leave, but turned back.
We do things different here in Stillwater.
Not anymore, we don't, Jack said.
Jessen watched in slack-jawed astonishment as Doc Poole walked away. Jack waited for him to explain what the man had been doing there, or to contradict Jack, kicking him off the scene. Instead, Jessen snapped on his left glove and stepped into the room.
Ever seen anything like this, Officer Jessen?
Well, call me Minor.
He shook his head.
Don't get many murders here.
Thank God. Assuming this is a murder-suicide, like it looks, Jack said, what else do you see?
Miner stepped toward the bed, turned green, swallowed, stepped back.
A nice gun. Beretta M92, preferred by military wannabes and veterans. Would have thought the gun had fallen out of her hand, what with the recoil.
Me too. Do you know the victims? Ever been in any trouble with the police?
I ran their names on the way over. No record of them.
Which means they're illegal.
Probably.
Diego?
Says he's new in town. Haven't run him yet, but illegal as well, I imagine.
But he stayed until you got here, anyway?
Miner nodded. Jack removed his gloves.
Who's responsible for processing the crime scene?
Well, for something like this, the county crime scene tech... York County got a nice mobile unit last year. He's on his way.
ETA?
Miner shrugged.
Probably pretty quick. It's only 10 miles to Yorkville. I'm surprised he ain't here.
Jack walked back to the living room. He could feel the vibrations of Diego's bouncing leg through the floor. He motioned for Freeman to come into the hall. Michael Freeman stared down the witness, freezing the man in place. He was Jack's height, but at least 50 pounds heavier, 7 pounds of Kevlar and 43 of muscle. The short sleeves of his perfectly pressed uniform shirt bunched above his bulging biceps. Miner, by contrast, was so slight of build his rumpled uniform might have been handed down from a taller, fatter brother. One was prepared for an invasion. One looked like he'd rather be fishing. Their dissimilarities didn't stop there. Freeman's eyes were vacant, neither hostile nor compassionate. Jack knew he would perform any task given him without comment or question. Miner's eyes were large, brown, and in constant motion.
Freeman, get your crime scene kit and take pictures. Start in the bedroom. After the tech has processed the scene, search all of the drawers and photograph what's inside, in the closet, under the bed, everything.
While the tech is working, unless he needs your help, photograph the rest of the house and outside.
Yes, sir.
He left. Miner, you talk to the neighbors. See if anyone heard anything. What Rosa and Gilberto's relationship was like. If they seen anyone around lately that shouldn't be around.
All right, he drawled.
First, find the baby and call CPS. Shouldn't there be another cop here?
Why, he quit.
Jack nodded. One fewer person to have to win over and one more thing to add to his to-do list. Hire. Get one of those sheriff's deputies out there to guard the front door. Tell him not to let anyone in this house that isn't properly booted and gloved. I'll talk to Diego. The man on the couch stood as Jack approached. Jack motioned for him to sit down.
Hola, Diego. Me llamo Jack McBride.
Bueno, habla español.
Si. The man relaxed, as Jack knew he would. Jack continued in Spanish.
Tell me what happened.
I came to pick Gilberto up for work. I got to the door, heard the baby screaming, and came in. I found the baby in her crib, red-faced, like she'd been crying a long time.
Diego leaned over, elbows on his knees, and stared at his clasped hands.
I knew it was bad. If they were in the house, they would not have let Carmen cry like that. I walked to their bedroom. Before I got to the door, I could smell the blood. The shit. I didn't want to look. I wish I didn't, but I thought one of them might be okay.
He wiped his eyes roughly. The palms of his hands were wet.
I called 911 and waited.
You did the right thing.
Diego nodded his head and stared at the floor. But, Jack continued, I have to wonder, why? Diego's head jerked up, his expression a mixture of anger and defensiveness.
Because you can't trust us wetbacks to follow the law?
No, because by doing so you risk being deported if you are here illegally. Officer Jessen seems to think you are. Is he right?
Diego's leg jiggled.
Diego, I'm not immigration. I don't care. I'm not about to deport someone who cared so much about his friends he stayed around to help even when it wasn't in his best interests.
Diego's leg stilled, but his hand found its way to his mouth. He chewed on the outside of his thumb.
So, why did you stay?
He removed his thumb, then spit whatever was in his mouth to the floor. Jack tried not to cringe.
That ain't right,
Diego said. He returned his finger to his mouth.
What?
Rosa would never kill Gilberto.
Diego, come on. This happens all the time.
Oh, man. My little sister wouldn't do that.
He motioned toward the bedroom.
I'm telling you.
Well, it looks like she did it. People go crazy sometimes, do things that are very out of character.
You weren't listening to me, Vato.
You weren't saying anything, Diego. Of course you don't think your sister would blow Gilberto's brains out while fucking him and then shoot herself. But you aren't giving me any other reason why this might have happened, or who might have done it.
Diego glared at him.
I don't know.
Were Gilberto and Rosa acting normal?
Yeah.
No fights?
I didn't see any.
They have any enemies?
How would I know? I've just been here a few days.
Drugs?
They take them?
No. Deal. Diego laughed.
No.
Where are you staying, Diego?
Diego shifted on the couch and didn't answer.
You're staying here, aren't you?
Yes.
Where were you last night?
I was down the street.
With who?
A girl named Esperanza.
All night?
From about midnight?
Jack sighed.
You know, this doesn't look good, Diego.
When I left, they were still alive.
When did you get back?
About 6:30. I called the police right away.
And he didn't leave. Nor did he try to solidify the murder-suicide theory by saying they were having problems. He went out of his way to say it wasn't possible. He was either incredibly stupid or not guilty. Jack stood.
All right, Diego.
Can I go?
Where would you go?
Diego didn't answer.
Stay here until I get back, then I'll take you to the station to get your statement.
I didn't do nothing,
then you have nothing to worry about. Diego looked away. His nervous tics returned in force. Jack didn't think he killed his sister and brother-in-law, but no one with a clear conscience would be so fidgety. He was hiding something. A sheriff's deputy entered the trailer.
"I'll be back soon. Sit tight," Jack said.
Jack told the deputy to guard Diego as well as the crime scene until he returned. He opened the screen door and stepped outside. A shaft of sunlight pierced through the clouds and shone across the hood of Jack's car. Ethan sat in the center of the beam, glaring at his father through the windshield. 2.
"Are you serious?"
"Come on, Ethan. It isn't that bad."
"You're right. It's horrible."
Jack leaned across Ethan and looked out the window.
"It does look like something out of The Walking Dead."
Ethan rolled his eyes and tried not to smile. His dad was not allowed to be funny while Ethan was mad at him. Ethan scowled.
"So, what am I supposed to do after school?"
"I'll pick you up this afternoon and we'll talk about it."
"Have you even thought about it?"
Jack's face tightened. His knuckles turned white on the steering wheel.
"Yes, Ethan. We'll talk about it after school. I have to go. Have a good day."
There. That was the dad it was easy to be mad at. Ethan jerked open the car door.
"Whatever."
He slammed it, hoping that his dad could feel his anger. But no, Ethan stood on the empty school sidewalk and watched his dad drive off without a wave. School or home? A day of trying to make friends with a bunch of country bumpkins, or a house full of unopened moving boxes and an empty refrigerator? 2 crappy choices, just like Mom used to give him.
"You can have green beans or broccoli. Which do you choose?"
"I want potatoes."
"You can have green beans or broccoli. Which do you choose?"
"Jesus, Jules, just let him have potatoes." Okay. So his dad wasn't all bad. Lately, though, it was his dad giving him the crappy choices, if he even gave him a choice at all. Ethan looked at the school. It was long, low, and brown, with bushes pruned down to sticks and very little grass.
It might look like something from a zombie apocalypse, but it would make a pretty cool picture. Add a couple of filters, get the light just right, and it might even look good.
From what Ethan had seen of the town, it was full of run-down buildings like this.
That was something. How pathetic that the most exciting thing in his life now was taking pictures of crappy buildings.
Choice number 3, grab his camera and explore the town. He put his backpack over both shoulders and started walking in the direction he thought his house was. Screw Stillwater and Eisenhower Junior High. He didn't want to be here. This school or this town. His dad never asked Ethan what he wanted. He just came home one day and said he had a new job. Ethan's first reaction was relief. He could get away from all the stupid people who knew the stupid thing he did. Then he thought of his mom. Did this mean she wasn't coming back? Did she know where they were? Had something awful happened to her and his dad just hadn't told him? Then his dad said they were moving, not with the FBI to another city somewhere cool like Colorado or California, but to a tiny town in nowhere, Texas. As freaking police chief. Sure, Ethan knew his dad was technically in law enforcement, being an FBI agent, but a police chief? Was he going to start wearing some ugly uniform and a cowboy hat? Arresting stinky rednecks in overalls and dirty caps for drugs and disorderly conduct? Ethan couldn't see it. His dad was a well-dressed desk jockey. He sat in a generic black car, drinking coffee, casing out terrorist safe houses, and saving the world. He drank expensive beer, got his hair cut every 3 weeks, polished his dress shoes while watching ESPN, and had 5 dark suits that all looked so much alike you had to look real close to tell them apart. He flossed twice a day, was clean-shaven, and had eyelashes so long they looked fake. For the record, Ethan only knew that because his mom used to tease his dad about his supermodel eyelashes. Jack McBride was a city boy through and through. Everyone here was going to hate him on sight.
There was no way he would last in this town. Ethan stopped at the end of the crumbling sidewalk. He could hate his dad for a lot of reasons, but people who didn't know him couldn't. They hadn't earned the right. Ethan figured they would soon enough, but he didn't want to be the cause of problems for his dad, at least not on the first day. Skipping school would cause a bunch of problems. He hadn't told anyone, especially his dad, but Ethan had resolved to try to get along here in Podunk, Texas. Not to make life easy on his dad, but maybe if he acted real good, somehow his mom would find out and come back. Ethan sighed, turned, and stumbled over the crack in the sidewalk. He kicked a chunk of loose concrete and trudged back to the school. The inside of the school was just as bad as the outside. Worse, actually, since it smelled like oranges. In front of him was the office. To the left and right were long halls lined with lockers and classroom doors. The hall to the left ended at a door with a sign labeling it as the library. Sunshine streamed through the glass doors at the end of the hall to the right. Ethan turned and looked back at the front door.
"You've got to be fucking kidding me. You lost?"
A young woman stared at him from the office door. Ethan took a step back and gripped the shoulder strap of his backpack. Great. Caught cussing in the first minute.
There goes my resolution to turn over a new leaf.
What would happen next? A talk with the principal? Detention? Corporal punishment? Well, surely not. No one did that anymore. Though this school might. These rednecks probably believed in that crap. This looked like the type of school that would have a big wooden paddle with holes drilled into the face. His Uncle Eddie said those were the worst. Dad didn't know firsthand. Of course. The woman standing in the doorway of the office was young, pretty, and, Ethan realized, trying very hard not to laugh. His grip loosened and his shoulders relaxed.
"It'd be pretty tough to get lost in a one-hall school," Ethan replied. "Good point. You must be Ethan. Come on in. I'll get you squared away."
She opened the door wider and stood aside.
"I'm Paige Grant," she said.
She smelled like flowers, and her lips were shiny with red lip gloss. Ethan wanted to smile, but his lips had turned to cement. He looked at the floor instead. Ms. Grant leaned over the counter and picked up Ethan's schedule.
"Here you go," she said. "Have a seat and look it over. Principal Corsi wants to say hi to you."
"Why?" Ethan asked. The principal had never personally greeted him before.
"She does it with all the new students. You get a lot of those here?"
Ms. Grant laughed.
"Not many, no."
She tilted her head to the side and appraised him.
"The girls are gonna love you."
Ethan's neck burned.
"The boys are gonna hate you."
"Great," Ethan said. He dropped his backpack to the floor and fell into an uncomfortable chair. A dusty orange Cheeto lay forgotten in the corner. A ring of grease had seeped out of it and onto the army green linoleum tile. Gross. Ethan vowed to never eat a Cheeto again. He tore his eyes away and read his schedule. English, science, math, lunch, social studies, gym, art. A small woman emerged from one of the offices behind the counter.
"Ethan McBride, welcome to Eisenhower Junior High."
He had never seen a principal with so much enthusiasm and energy. In his varied experience, they were usually frazzled and beaten down and happy not to know your name. If they knew your name, that usually meant you were a troublemaker. Of course, those were schools with 700-plus students. A small school in a small town was different, he guessed.
"Hello, Principal Corsi."
He held out his hand and smiled. Adults love that crap.
"Well, look at those manners."
Big voice for a little woman, but her grip was weak. Dad said never to trust a weak handshake.
"What a little gentleman. I like it."
Ethan caught Paige Grant's eye. She winked at him and picked up the phone.
"I've seen your transcript. You're a good student. Maybe a little challenged with math, but that's okay. We'll get you up to speed in no time. Even so, you've had really good test scores, which is great. Star testing is coming up, you know. I see you have your schedule."
She turned to Ms. Grant.
Let's get someone,
she started. Paige Grant replaced the phone.
I've already called Mrs. Wright's room for Olivia. Their schedules are almost the same.
She smiled so sweetly and innocently at him, Ethan immediately became suspicious.
Excellent!
Principal Corsi clapped her hands.
Well, I hope this is the last time I see you in the office.
She gripped his shoulder, leaned forward, and said in an undertone,
I'm sure we won't have any of the same issues you had at your previous school, will we,
Her large smile could not mask the threat in her brittle green eyes. Ethan tried to not cringe as her thin fingers dug into his shoulders.
So my principal is Dolores Umbridge. Good to know.
No, ma'am.
She released him and patted his shoulder.
Good. Have a nice day. Yes, ma'am. It was a pleasure meeting you.
Corsi turned, her hard eyes searching Ethan for any sign of sarcasm. Ethan, a master at faking out adults when he wanted, showed her every one of his teeth.
I like your necklace. My mom has one just like it, he lied.
Corsi's eyes narrowed.
How nice. Bye,
Ethan said, waving and smiling. When Corsi closed the door of her office, he dropped the smile and sat down to wait for Olivia, whoever she was. He sighed.
Why can't it ever be easy?
The door opened and a girl stormed in.
What is so important that you had to get me out of English? Olivia, meet our newest eighth grader, Ethan McBride,
Paige Grant said with a mischievous smile. The girl turned and stared. He half expected her to be as hostile to him as she was to Ms. Grant. Instead, her eyes widened, her face turned red, and she looked away.
Hi,
she said. She rounded on the young woman, making Ethan say hi to her back. She whispered to Ms. Grant, who laughed.
You two have basically the same schedule, so I thought you could show him around today. Troy has the same schedule as I do,
Olivia said.
Does he? I didn't know.
Olivia said something else in a low voice. Ethan was pretty sure he heard the word dead.
Come on.
Olivia walked out the door. He picked up his backpack and followed.
Let's find your locker.
She held her hand out for his schedule. She turned it over.
Locker 526. It's around the corner at the end of the hall.
Gosh, I hope I make it to class on time. She ignored him.
This is the 5th and 6th grade hall. That,
she jerked her thumb over her shoulder,
is the 7th grade hall. The 8th grade hall is around the corner from the library.
So there are two halls. Very impressive.
Just what we need. Another sarcastic 8th grader.
They rounded the corner into the 8th grade hall and stopped at his locker.
You'll spend most of your time in this hall. The school doesn't allow backpacks in the classroom, or cell phones, iPods, any electronics.
She handed his schedule back. Ethan tried to open the combination lock 3 times, his face getting hotter with each attempt.
Want me to try?
Olivia asked.
No, I can get it.
Whatever. I'd like to get back to class before the bell rings.
Is English that interesting? It's better than watching you try to open a lock.
Oh, good grief.
She pushed Ethan aside. She twisted the lock around and back and pulled the handle.
Grab a spiral and a pen.
She walked off down the hall before he could respond. She was waiting outside a door halfway down the hall. When he was almost there, she entered the room, leaving him to walk into a room full of strangers by himself. Olivia sat in the front row, of course. A middle-aged teacher with flyaway hair was looking at him over her reading glasses.
Class, we have a new student. Come in, come in. Ethan, isn't it?
Yes, ma'am.
I'm Mrs. Wright. There's a seat in the back corner.
Ethan settled into his desk and stared at the backs of his new classmates. From this angle, they looked like every other classmate he'd ever had. A few girls were sneaking glances back at him. The boys, who were in the back of the room with him, were mostly ignoring him, though a boy sitting behind Olivia turned and waved.
Troy,
Mrs. Wright said,
eyes on me, please. Ethan, just grab a textbook from that shelf next to you, page 145.
The class ended with a pop quiz over a book he read in 7th grade. Students filed out of the room, placing the quiz on the teacher's desk. Mrs. Wright, gave him a warm smile.
Welcome to Stillwater, Ethan.
Thank you, Mrs. Wright.
Olivia and the friendly boy were waiting for him outside the classroom.
This is my brother Troy, Olivia said without preamble. His locker is close to yours, so he's going to show you around the rest of the day.
Hey, Ethan said.
Hey,
Troy said.
They weaved through the throng of curious eighth graders. Ethan kept his eyes down.
That's got to be a record, Ethan said.
What?
I've never made an enemy in the first hour of school. Usually it's around lunchtime.
Have you moved around a lot?
A little.
Weird.
Troy unlocked his locker.
I've lived here all my life. I can't imagine going to a different school.
You get used to it, Ethan said.
Groups of girls were walking past, staring at him and giggling. The boys puffed out their chests and continued to pointedly ignore him.
Some of it, anyway.
Troy closed his locker.
Olivia doesn't hate you.
Ethan opened his locker on the first try.
Of course. Well, she doesn't like me.
Olivia likes everybody.
Could have fooled me.
She gets like that when she's mad.
I didn't do anything to piss her off.
Oh, she's not mad at you. She's mad at Paige.
The woman from the office? Why?
Well, sisters are always mad at each other, it seems like.
They're sisters?
Yep.
Troy was nodding at people as they walked down the hall.
So your dad is the new police chief?
Yeah.
What's your mom do?
She's a consultant.
No idea what that is.
Me either.
As lies went, though, it was pretty good. Generic and uninteresting enough to not encourage more questions.
She not move here with y'all?
Usually. How did you know that?
Oh, everybody knows that.
Ethan rummaged in his locker and let that sink in for a moment. He didn't know a thing about this kid, or the town, the school, or anyone in the town, and it seemed that they knew everything about him. His stomach dropped at the thought.
So, your parents separated, divorced?
She's on a business trip.
Oh, cool.
Ethan slammed his locker door and started walking.
He didn't want to think of his mom right now. Starting a new school was bad enough. The last thing he needed to do was start crying.
3. Desperate for coffee and running on fumes, Jack pulled into the Chevron, started the gas pump, and walked inside. A bell jingled. All conversation stopped. All eyes turned to him. Next to the front windows to his right were three booths, one occupied with four old men. Steaming cups of coffee sat in front of each. Behind the counter stood a man wearing oversized overalls and an International Harvester hat that had seen its fair share of harvests. Jack nodded and said, "Morning," and made for the coffee pot at the back of the store. He poured four cups, snapped on the lids, and wedged the cups into a cardboard traveler. He shoved a handful of creamers, sweeteners, sugars, and stir straws in his coat pocket. Balancing the traveler in one hand, he walked to the counter to pay, pulling two honey buns off a shelf on the way. The man behind the counter rang him.
$2.16.
Jack held his wallet open.
$2 for all of this?
Cups get coffee free.
Jack smiled.
Thanks, but I'd rather pay for all of it.
The clerk glanced over Jack's shoulder before adjusting the price.
$6.55.
Jack handed him a 10, received his change, and put his honey buns in his empty coat pocket. He was almost out the door when one of the men from the booth spoke up.
"Here you got a pretty grisly scene out there at the trailer park."
Jack paused, his hand on the door handle.
"Where did you hear that?"
The man shrugged.
"Small town. News travels fast."
The other men stared into their coffee cups. The clerk leaned against the back counter, arms crossed over his ample chest, and watched. An avalanche of new ice fell in the ice maker. The coffee pot clicked off. Strains of country music, tinny and flat, floated from a radio on the counter behind the clerk. Breakfast taquitos and hot dogs rolled in their warmer. The man who spoke drank his coffee, placed the cup on the table, and said,
"Careful you don't get your nice shoes dirty."
Jack smirked.
"Always my top priority," he said, and pushed through the door. Jack parked behind the crime scene van. In the 20 minutes he was gone, the crowd around the trailer had grown, as had the line of rubberneckers on the road. Nathan Starling stood in the same spot, his back to the crowd. He didn't seem to mind being on the periphery of the action, but looked happy to just be involved in something bigger than him. The cup of coffee Jack gave him brought out all of the nervous gratitude typical in a young man overwhelmed by his superiors. Jack talked to him for a minute, thanked him for taking care of the edge of the scene, and told him they would all meet later today to discuss the case. Starling yes-sired Jack to death, and Jack walked away, smiling at his eagerness. Diego sat on the couch and watched Mike Freeman take pictures of everything. With no expression, Freeman thanked Jack for the coffee, but said he didn't drink it. Jack gave it to Diego, took his own cup from the carrier, placed Miner's coffee on the kitchen table, and walked down the hall. Sheriff Ann Newberry stood outside the bedroom door, watching the tech process the scene. In her early 50s and a law enforcement lifer, Ann Newberry started her career as a prison guard at the Women's Penitentiary in Gatesville, Texas. She attended night classes at Central Texas College, worked 12-hour shifts, and raised her daughter by herself. She was tough, fair, intelligent, and incorruptible. Her razor-sharp wit was all the more deadly. Very few people realized she was making fun of them. Jack had known her for almost 20 years, since he had worked with her on a nationwide prison gang case his first year with the agency. He had liked her immediately. The fact that she was the sheriff of York County had been one of the items in the pro column when he was deciding whether to take this job. "Jack McBride." Her voice was deeper than the last time he had talked to her. They shook hands. "Still smoking a pack a day, I hear."
"Well, everyone does of something."
"Good to see you, Ann." She moved aside. They stood together in the doorway and watched the tech take pictures.
"Nasty business," she said.
"Not the first case I wanted to catch."
"I suppose not."
She crossed her arms over her chest.
"You just missed the coroner. She put the time of death between midnight and 2. Had Josh over there."
The crime scene tech looked up and nodded.
"Do a quick GSR check on old Diego out there. He's clean, so he wasn't the shooter. Look these two up before I came. No records, never been questioned about anything. Clean, except for the fact they're illegal, that is."
"Yeah, that's what Miner said. I've got him out questioning the neighbors." Ann snorted.
"He won't get very far, even if he could speak Spanish. They aren't going to talk to the police, especially Miner."
"Why especially Miner?"
"He was with Buck Pollard longer than anyone."
Buck Pollard. The name hung over Stillwater like a pall. The former police chief had abruptly retired in June, with no explanation other than age and a desire to do a little more fishing. During Jack's interview process, which had happened mostly over the phone, Pollard's retirement was glossed over so quickly and smoothly, Jack knew something was sketchy. Jack's research had turned up very little except an excellent crime rate and whispers of corruption, though no formal investigation had ever been instigated.
"Are you saying Miner's corrupt?"
Ann shrugged.
"He hasn't been implicated."
She turned to face Jack. She hadn't changed much from when Jack had first met her. Petite, with a pixie haircut and blue eyes, she still reminded him of Peter Pan, though, unlike Peter, age was starting to show in the generous amount of gray sprinkled through her hair and the fine lines around her eyes.
"I can't believe you took this job."
"Why?" Jack sipped his coffee.
"Captain Ambition, patrolling a dying town."
Jack winced at the nickname bestowed on him by older, slower, and less intelligent agents during the prison gang case. He hadn't heard it in a while. Ann had enough contacts that Jack was sure she knew the story, or at least part of the story, of why he left the agency. The Ann he remembered was always direct. He wondered why she was fishing instead of asking straight out. If she asked, he would answer. But he hated passive-aggressive bullshit. He kept his eye on the two bodies and changed the subject.
"What's your gut instinct on this?"
She was either one vindictive bitch or someone did a crappy job trying to make this look like a murder-suicide.
He nodded. Ann patted him on the shoulder.
Come down to Yorkville first chance you get. I'll give you the lowdown on York County.
Oh, no need. I Googled it, Jack said.
Really?
Ann said.
What did Google say?
It was Wikipedia, actually. You have a booming meth business, lots of child abuse, spousal abuse, and hot checks.
Oh, don't forget endemic corruption.
Does that include the sheriff's department? She laughed.
I don't care why you're here, I'm just glad you are. It's going to be a hell of a lot more fun around here with you stirring the pot.
She walked down the hall and waved over her shoulder.
Try to stay out of trouble, McBride.
The second interrogation of Diego Vasquez yielded nothing new. He was steadfast in his belief that Rosa and Gilberto were happily married and neither of them had enemies. The couple basked in the glow of perfection of the recently deceased. Their faults and imperfections would be glossed over for weeks and eventually only talked about in apologetic tones or with an indulgent laugh. Jack parked Diego in one of the three damp holding cells in the City Hall basement and heard an earful of Spanish insults for his trouble. When Diego finished, Jack said, "This is for your own protection. How's that? If you're right and Rosa didn't do this, then maybe the killer was there for you. Ever thought of that?" Diego paused and then said, "No one wants to kill me. Maybe, maybe not. But just to be safe..." Jack jingled the keys in his pocket. "I'll bring you some lunch. Burger okay? I'm not hungry. I'll bring it anyway. Get some rest," Jack said. Jack walked up the back stairs of City Hall to the second-floor offices that served as the city police station. Space was at a premium, which meant every room was cramped and pulled double duty. The break room was also the interrogation room. The radio operator was crammed in the storage closet. Four deputies shared two offices. The only office on the second floor that wasn't doubled up was Jack's. A large wooden desk with a well-worn brown leather office chair sat in the center of the large rectangular office. To the left, five mismatched chairs surrounded a round wooden table on which sat an empty, dirty ashtray on loan from the 1970s. Metal filing cabinets of various ages, colors, and heights took up every available inch of space on the east and west walls. Behind the desk, the northern wall was a bank of leaded glass windows overlooking the Cypress River, the natural boundary of Stillwater's square. Through the willows lining the riverbank, Jack could just make out the back of his house across the water. Jack pulled the chair out from under the desk, draped his jacket on the back, and sat down. The town had only five policemen, including the chief, and the simplicity of the single hall with five offices was initially appealing to Jack, but now he was here, committed and in charge, it seemed second-rate and dingy. Jack opened the middle desk drawer while he waited for the bulky desktop computer to boot up. Bent paper clips, stubby pencils with broken leads and nubby erasers, Bic pens, their clear barrels smeared inside with exploded blue ink, dried-out liquid paper, a torn portion of carbon paper. Did anyone even use this stuff anymore? Thumbtacks, an empty can of Skull, a dried-out stamp pad, and a date stamp last used on April 26, 1993. He closed the drawer, noting that it neither opened all the way nor closed all the way. On the edge of the left side of the desk, a portion of the wooden top was discolored and worn down in the perfect shape of a boot heel. He imagined a bald, fat man reclining in the chair, a pair of pointy-toed cowboy boots propped up on the desk, a paper cup of dip spit balanced on his round stomach. Susan Grant, the receptionist, knocked on the door jamb, the lid of an envelope box overflowing with office supplies balanced on her arm.
"Did Buck clean you out?"
"Yes, he did." She placed the box on his desk.
"I have the key to the supply closet. I also ordered the supplies, so if there's something we don't have that you need, just let me know."
"Can I get a new desk and a new computer?" She smiled.
"The big stuff goes through Earl, the city manager."
Jack pulled the box forward, opened a side drawer, and dumped the contents inside.
Susan leaned forward, a stricken expression on her face, before recalling herself and straightening. She bit her lip and said,
"My daughter says Ethan is all settled in at school."
"Your daughter?"
"My oldest, Paige. She graduated last year. Now she works in the office at Eisenhower. She made sure my youngest two, Troy and Olivia, met Ethan this morning."
"Well, that was nice of her."
"What will Ethan do after school?"
Jack ran his hands over the top of the desk. Despite what he had told Ethan, he hadn't given it nearly enough thought. He didn't have the neighborhood friends to help out now. The parents who had been so willing to help him out after Julie left, but whose good nature and helpfulness ran its course when weeks passed and suspicions mounted. Though Jack hadn't thought of specifics, his ability to cope on his own was part of the reason he took a job in a small town. Not the only reason, or even the biggest reason, but it played a part. Susan waited for an answer.
"Not sure yet," Jack said.
The computer on his desk lit up, saving him elaborating.
Looks like I need a password.
Susan came around the desk, opened the drawer, grimaced again, pulled out a pink pad of sticky notes and a pen, and closed the drawer with a snap. She wrote "Chief" and "PSSWRD" in tiny block letters.
"Here, be sure to change it."
She pulled the note off and stuck it on the desk and laid the pen next to it.
"I need to get back up front."
She pointed at the phone.
"I'm Zero on the intercom. Page me if you need me."
Jack was relieved she didn't offer to help with Ethan. He would have taken her up on it, and if past was predictor of future behavior, which he knew it was, he would have taken advantage of Susan's good nature in the end. She turned at the door.
"Don't forget about your 10 o'clock at the bank."
Jack was taken aback. He had forgotten.
"How did you know about that?"
"Ellie called. Thought you might forget with everything going on."
Jack looked at his watch. "I guess I better get over there since technically Ethan and I are trespassing until I sign the papers." He still couldn't believe Ellie let him move into the house before finalizing the paperwork. He supposed she thought it was a safe bet since he was the chief of police. Jack walked around the desk, putting on his jacket as he went. He stood in the doorway, facing Susan, and adjusted his collar.
"My desk drawer is driving you crazy, isn't it?"
She blushed.
"How did you know that?"
"If it makes you feel better to organize it, be my guest. Feel free to fix my middle drawer while you're at it."
Susan walked around the desk and opened the side drawer.
"Can't you fix it?"
"Probably not."
Susan's mouth curled into a smirk.
"If you can't fix a desk drawer, then you probably bought the wrong house."
4. Jack's footsteps echoed around Stillwater National Bank's expansive and surprisingly quiet lobby. Behind the nearest teller window, a woman in an outdated uniform glanced up, first with curiosity, then recognition. She patted her gray, tightly permed hair, which Jack guessed hadn't moved an inch in 30 years, and with homespun professionalism asked him,
"How can I help you, sir?"
She had a thick southern drawl and a wide smile.
"Jack McBride, I have an appointment."
"Yes, sir, if you'd like to have a seat," she said.
She motioned across the lobby to a group of chairs huddled around a coffee table. Jack took in the stiff, old-fashioned chairs and decided to stand. Though not large, the bank was impressive in the way old banks were. The entire building, from the facade to the inside with its gleaming white marble floors, tall ceilings, chandeliers, and heavy oak desks centered on oriental rugs, spoke of permanence, a safe place to put your money and store your valuables. The bank customers, most older than 50 years old, were straight out of central casting for a small-town, old-fashioned drama. A couple of farmers, a house painter, a lawyer, and a retired schoolteacher, if Jack wasn't mistaken, stood at the two counters in the middle of the lobby, filling out deposit slips, counting their money, signing checks, and trying to hide their interest in the tall stranger standing in the middle of the bank.
"Sure don't look like no cop I've ever seen. City boy for sure, Jesus H. Christ.
Moved here to get his son away from the city. He's a troublemaker, no doubt. He won't last a week."
a woman dressed identically to the teller who greeted Jack, but 30 years younger, rose from behind one of the desks and approached him.
"Welcome to Stillwater, Chief McBride."
She held out her hand and smiled.
"I'm Ellie Martin. It's nice to finally meet you in person."
Jack smiled. Her smooth alto twang was as intriguing as he remembered. "Call me Jack, please. And we've met before, at Valerie Patterson's funeral." Ellie brushed a piece of wispy hair, not tied back in her loose bun, away from her face.
"Of course. I wasn't sure if you remembered. Right this way."
As he followed Ellie Martin, years of FBI training kicked in. Jack had assessed, cataloged, and profiled her by the time she sat down and looked up from the single stack of papers on her desk. She was attractive but unremarkable, taller than average, around 5'8". Jack could tell little about her figure. The uniform she wore was 20 years out of style and unflattering. Jack remembered his grandmother wearing a similar outfit back in the 1970s. Her skirt was loose at the hips and the waist bunched beneath a thin leather belt, telltale signs of significant weight loss. She walked with her head held high, but without even a bit of sway to her hips. He guessed that no one had ever given her an appreciative whistle as she walked down the street. Ellie Martin would be a good conversationalist, but not the woman men went out of their way to buy a beer for. All of her best friends would be beautiful, nice, and loyal, a rare combination that Ellie had a knack for attracting, and would sincerely argue with her when she laughed at her bad luck with men. Jack guessed she was around his age, though she could have been as young as 35 or as old as 45. She motioned for him to have a seat.
"I hear you've had an eventful morning."
Jack sat back and crossed his legs.
"Yes, not exactly what I was hoping for on my first day."
"I imagine not. What a tragedy."
"I don't suppose you knew them."
"Actually, I did. Slightly. Gilberto was a day laborer, as you probably know. He helped me move a few weeks ago, back in July."
"Do you know the names of the other day laborers?"
She scrunched her nose.
"Only one. Raul. They wait for work at the Chevron. You might be able to find him there. Sorry I can't be more help."
"Oh, it is a help. Thank you."
She tucked the errant strand of hair behind her ear and said,
"Did your son make it to school all right?"
"How did you know I had a son?"
"I believe Jane mentioned it."
She waved her hand.
"I don't mean to pry. I'm sorry."
"No, not at all. It's just
weird that a stranger knows. That's a small town for you."
"Well, to answer your question, yes. Ethan made it to school okay. Susan Grant, the receptionist."
Ellie smiled.
"I've known Susan since sophomore year in high school."
Jack paused, felt his face redden for the first time in years.
"Of course you do. I bet you know everyone in town."
"Pretty much."
"Well, Susan said Ethan is squared away."
"Good."
Jack thought back to the morning and a dozen ways he could have made it go easier. In the moment, it had been difficult to stop and think of what would be the best way to react to his emotional, hormonal, angry teenager, especially in the morning when Jack's moods were not conducive to coddling, coaxing, and commiserating. For almost a year, their time together had been an extended version of the quiet game. So far, Ethan was winning. If Ellie Martin saw Jack's discomfort at thoughts of his son, she didn't let on.
"I believe we have everything in order for you. Your bank account is open and checks are on order. Though who uses checks these days? Still..."
She pushed a thin checkbook across the desk.
"These are temporary. Your ATM card will come in the mail. Direct deposit with the city has been set up. Your mortgage is set up for auto payment also. I take it all of your utilities were connected when you arrived."
"Yes."
"Good."
She folded her hands on the desk and leaned forward slightly. Jack noticed a chickenpox scar just under her left eyebrow. Her eyes looked more green than hazel now and had a combination of intelligence and humor he rarely saw but was always attracted to.
"You have beautiful eyes."
Ellie Martin straightened, her mouth gaping in astonishment. Jack couldn't believe he had said it either. The click of her teeth as she clamped her mouth shut was audible. She dropped her eyes to the stack of papers on her desk.
I'm so sorry.
Jack said. That was, he cleared his throat. Completely inappropriate. I don't know why I said that. I mean, I do. You do have beautiful eyes, but... But what? Jesus Christ, what was he doing? She regained her composure sooner than Jack.
Thank you,
she said. Her voice cracked as she said it. She looked at her folded hands and cleared her throat. When she looked back at Jack, she had regained some, though not all, of her professionalism. Her voice was slightly higher than normal when she asked,
"How are you settling in?"
He grasped the conversational life raft.
"We haven't, really. Lots of boxes."
"I find the best thing to do is to focus on one room a day. Makes it more manageable,"
Ellie said.
"Have you moved often?"
"No, I have lived in Stillwater all my life."
"Oh." He couldn't fathom it. Why would someone choose to stay in a small town like this for their entire life? What life events kept her in a town where there were limited possibilities for success instead of moving to a city where opportunities were endless? Early marriage? Children? Parents? Lack of ambition? Or maybe she wanted to be an important person in a small town instead of one of millions in a city.
"Are you profiling me?"
He shifted in his chair, caught out. Thank God she seemed amused instead of offended. Still, he feigned ignorance. "Sorry?"
"Either I've sprouted a second head or you were trying very hard to figure out why I've lived in Stillwater my entire life."
"I'm usually much more subtle about it."
"I would hope so."
"Or maybe you're more perceptive than most."
"Maybe I am, though I wish I'd been half as perceptive when I was younger."
"Don't we all? Would have saved a lot of needless drama."
"You too?"
Jack nodded. He wondered how long her hair was. It had been shoulder length a year ago. Were the light streaks in her hair natural or out of a bottle? Regardless, he imagined her hair was soft, silky even. He looked away. "Jesus, McBride, what are you thinking about? You have two dead people in a trailer not a mile from here, and instead of finishing your business as quickly as possible, you're pondering the texture and color of a woman's hair whom you've seen twice and talked to on the phone a couple of times."
"Jack?"
Her voice jerked him back into the present. She had called him Jack.
"Huh. How did you become so perceptive?"
he asked, just remembering the thread of their conversation. Poor Gilberto and Rosa would have to wait. "Hard-earned experience?"
"Maybe,"
she replied.
"Or maybe I've just read a lot of mysteries."
"Oh, you mean the ones where there's a new chief of police in town and he needs the help of the local preacher, hairdresser, or bank executive to solve crimes?"
"A bank executive?"
"Sure, why not?"
"I can't imagine 10-key skills would come in handy in solving crimes."
"You would be a forensic accountant on the side."
"Would I? What is that?"
she asked.
"They follow the money. There's always a money trail."
Her eyes narrowed and her smile dropped a fraction.
"My guess is it wouldn't be very interesting to read about," she said.
"Maybe you're right. Not like the ones with the cats and the recipes. They're surprisingly good, you know."
"You expect me to believe you read cozy mysteries?"
He shrugged.
"It takes the edge off of a long day."
She shook her head and chuckled.
"Well, our book wouldn't have recipes. I can't cook. Can you?"
"No. I bet you have a cat, though. Named Sherlock or Watson. Or maybe Mr. Darcy. No. Wait."
He put his hand to his chin. "You named your cat after Poe's detective. Can't remember his name. French-sounding, though."
"Maupin?"
Jack grinned.
"Am I right?"
She inhaled and paused, as if she was about to confess his brilliance.
"No,"
she sighed.
"I don't have a cat. You aren't a very good profiler, are you?"
Her whiskey-soaked chuckle stirred an emotion inside Jack he had thought was long dead.
"I guess not."
"That's okay. Your secret is safe with me."
Jack studied her. They'd met so briefly at the funeral, and he'd been distracted with his own personal problems, so he hadn't paid much attention to her. He remembered her voice, her eyes, her protectiveness of Valerie's parents, and her spunk. He couldn't help but smile. He suspected she would hate being called spunky. Now she wore little makeup, apparently not concerned with masking the small lines around her eyes or the faint freckles dusting her nose. When she smiled, which was often, the left side of her mouth crooked up higher than her right, making her look mischievous, ready to pull an epic prank. Her fingers were long and thin. Her nails were manicured, but without polish. She wore no ring, nor was there a shiny strip of skin on an accidentally naked ring finger. Jack felt a pang of pity for all the men who hadn't bothered to buy Ellie Martin a beer. A blush crept up her neck to her cheeks. She looked down at her desk. Could she read his mind? He looked around the bank to find something boring and innocuous to talk about. They spoke at the same time. "Well, this isn't it." She held out a file.
"The sign..."
They stopped, like two embarrassed teenagers struggling to make conversation on a first date. Blushing suited her.
You go," Jack said.
"No, you."
"I was just saying this is an interesting building."
And she was off, rattling information about the building.
"Well, this is one of the oldest buildings in Stillwater, one of the first built of stone, which is why it survived the 1889 fire. It was designed and built in 1882 by Jean Robichaud. He was from France via Louisiana, as you might expect with a name like Robichaud. But he was forgiven for the sin of being a Frenchman when he married a local girl. He lived in Stillwater for 60 years until his death in..."
She took a breath.
"And I'm rambling. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to bore you. I forget sometimes that other people aren't as interested in history as I am."
"I'm not bored," Jack said, though he had no idea what she had just told him. Her voice soothed him, pushed out of his mind all the shit that led to him sitting in this chair across a desk from a woman he was finding he wanted to get in a quiet corner of a dark bar and talk to for hours.
"I guess I know who I need to see if I have questions about Stillwater," Jack said with a smile, hoping to put her at ease as well as mask what he was feeling.
"Of course, I'd be happy to help."
She picked up the forgotten file and laid it on the desk in front of him.
"Are you ready to close on your new house?"
Jack sat forward.
"And your old one?"
She opened the file.
"If you will just sign where it is marked."
She removed a pen from the stand on her desk and handed it to him.
"You might want to flex your hand. There's a lot to sign."
Jack flipped open the file and signed below the seller's signature, Elliot York. Jack looked up.
"York? As in Yorkville? York County?"
Ellie stared at the paperwork.
"Yes, I'm a descendant of the founders,"